The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I am Peter Terzakian. Welcome back. Well, Jackie, I'm getting kind of tired of saying it's been another big week, but it has been a big week. This is Earth Week, April 19th to 25th, and concurrent with Earth Week, we had the White House Biden Climate Summit with all sorts of commitments that were being made by world leaders.
Yeah, President, big targets.
Yeah, what a President Biden committing to 50% reduction in emissions by 2030 relative to the 2005 baseline in the United States. Here in Canada, our own prime minister committing to 45%.
Well, hey, it was a big week for targets because on Monday with the budget, we committed to 36% reduction by 2030 relative to 2005. And that was only like 4 days old, that new goal, because it was 30 before that. And now it's 40 to 45. So things are really 9%, moving along.
9% per week.
Yeah.
Okay, well, you can do the projections for next week. But speaking of projections, the Bank of Canada is also signaling about potential interest rate hikes and potentially some looming inflation, which is big talk actually around the world. And we're going to have a separate session on that sometime in the next few weeks because inflation is definitely a concern. And actually, we may even have a bit of conversation around that today because we have a special guest today who is most capable in talking about all these sorts of economic issues, whether they're broad economy based or related to the energy economy. I am absolutely delighted to introduce an old friend of mine, which is John Stackhouse. John is the Senior Vice President in the Office of the CEO of RBC. So welcome, John.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Jackie. Great to be with you.
Before we get started with the long laundry list of economic issues that we want to talk about with you, just give us a snapshot of where you've come from and your role in the office of the CEO at RBC.
Yeah, you probably don't want to hear my whole life story. It's not that interesting. But as you mentioned, I've been at RBC now for 6.5 years. But before that, I had spent most of my working life in journalism. I was at the Globe and Mail for a number of years and up until 2014, editor-in-chief. I think, Peter, I got to know you in earlier incarnation there when I was running the report on business. Mm-hmm. I spent a lot of time in Calgary a couple of cycles ago. Had a great run at the Globe. And after leaving the Globe, I was spending a bit of time at the Monk School of Global Affairs at U of T and at the C.D. Howe Institute working on some research projects, including one that's now a book that has just come out called Planet Canada. And always been really interested in kind of the direction of Canada. I love that aspect of journalism and wanted to continue to explore the challenges, but also the opportunities for the country in a very different age, and got into a conversation with Dave McKay when he became CEO of RBC. We had known each other previously, and he actually wanted a non-banker in his orbit. He's got plenty of really smart bankers around him and just wanted someone who might bring some different perspectives. So we decided to give it a go. And I said 6.5 years later, it's still going. So hopefully we're adding to the national conversation.
Great. Well, it's great to have you. And we will put a link to your book in the show notes for people to go check out. So today we want to talk about a lot of topics. We're going to really grill you here. The Canadian economy and competitiveness, which you've written on. We want to talk about Canada's energy future as we think about the next decade and all these targets. We'll maybe talk specifically about the new targets. And then sustainable finance, ESG and such. You know, obviously at RBC, you guys think a lot about this. So some questions around where that's all going.
That is a long laundry list, but let's just start out with the here and the now. And we've got this pandemic that's still raging away. We're in the third wave, as they call it. But there are definitely signs, whether it's in the United States or abroad or even here, that the economy seems to be perking up, which is almost a contradiction given the state of the health of the country, physical health of people. Why don't you give us a sense of how RBC is viewing that, the outlook for the Canadian economy over the next couple of years?
Yeah, it's been fascinating. And I have the privilege of working with the economics team at RBC, so get to be in a lot of interesting conversations, especially through the pandemic. No easy time to be a forecaster for sure, partly because there's just so much noise and not a lot of great signals in such a volatile economy. We're seeing that now with the lockdowns, which kind of gives everyone a sense of gloom or foreboding. And yet, things are looking pretty strong. The indicators, as you mentioned, out of the U.S. are very robust. and we're anticipating strong growth, especially in the back half of the year. Even in the front half of the year, it's impressive to see the resilience, especially of the consumer, but also of a lot of sectors. I know there's a lot of sectors, retail, obviously, that are going through brutal times, but a lot of sectors, manufacturing, construction, amongst them, are doing pretty well. And as demand grows, they're going to pick up as well. And we're going to see more investment, especially on the government side. We'll get to that.
Yeah, we're going to get to that, giving
your comments on the budget. But overall, we've got a good outlook for this year. And we think if there's risk, it's on the upside, primarily because of the extraordinary amount of savings that there are in the world. Depending on your count, $5 trillion of fairly liquid savings around the planet, a couple billion of that in North America, ready to go.
Is that people just staying home and not spending money on vacations and going out? Is that where it's coming from?
Peter, it's that simple. Like, we're seeing this in checking accounts. Unbelievable amounts of money sitting in basic accounts.
Yeah.
Because people, they don't have things to spend it on. They're cautious. Income flows have been good. A lot of people are still on payrolls, but the government supports, which were necessary, have had that effect.
So they are using that money to spend on renovations and buying new homes and things. And so that constitutes a big pull on things like our natural resources, our forestry, metals, minerals, oil and gas, manufacturing, and so on. And a lot of this is probably because Canada's economy is codependent with the U.S. and they are further ahead than us in vaccinations and getting out of this soup faster than we are.
Yeah, and we're going to see some interesting bottlenecks. You're seeing this in lumber prices. Anyone who's tried to buy lumber lately has probably had sticker shock. We may see that in other prices, partly because of that surge in demand, especially in the U.S., but also bottlenecks, including at ports, which is going to be interesting to see play out through the year as the economy opens up.
Okay, well, that's good. It's good to have some good news for once when we talk about the economy. Let's switch to talking about the new budget. The federal government earlier this week introduced the budget, including $100 billion of new spending, added COVID support to get us through the last third wave here, as well as funds to stimulate economic growth, including 30% to childcare. So most of it went to childcare. That was the biggest bucket, but also $17 billion to clean and green energy. Overall, what are your impressions of the budget?
It's a very, very ambitious budget, quite long, a record in length and record in dollar figures. And we need an extraordinary budget because this is obviously an extraordinary time. More commitments than we felt were necessary and spread across more aspects of the economy than may be needed. There's certainly some political signaling, no doubt about that, but also a bit of preparedness that if things continue to be a grind or a challenge in different parts of the economy, that commitments are there and maybe they can dial those back as the economy opens up. That's our hope, that some of these commitments won't actually need to be spent because the economy will gain its own steam.
I was just going to say, based on your first question about the economic outlook being so good, and I think the Bank of Canada agrees with that as well with their news this week, do we need stimulus? Is the economy already going to be almost overheated?
Well, stimulus has become an overused term, and a lot of spending commitments, and this is true around the world, aren't really stimulus. And you see that in the budget. There's a number of things are called investments, even though they're really just transfers. Those transfers, especially to individuals and businesses, are critical when things are in lockdown. They're important economically, but also from a public health point of view to help people stay at home and socially distance. When we don't need to stay at home, those transfers aren't needed. So let's hope the dial can be moved fairly quickly on those. The longer term stimulus initiatives are quite interesting. You mentioned energy investments, for instance, under the Green File or childcare. Those could be really transformative for the Canadian economy. We've got lots of productivity challenges, some labor force participation challenges, although significant improvement on that front over the years. And those investments, if they're wisely spent, not just helicopter money, could have a significant impact on the economy. It's interesting in the budget, there's not a lot of indicators of what the expected multiplier effect is of those investments. So that's something that's kind of worth some deeper thought.
Yeah, how it multiplies and stimulates the economy is going to be something to watch, definitely. Stimulus, I agree, is sort of an overused word. And how it's applied is really important. But ultimately, the money has to come from somewhere. and we're projecting a deficit in this country of $350 billion this year. We know a lot of that is pandemic related, but that's just huge. And even in one of your recent articles, I think you called the federal deficit being abysmal in your own words. Could you give us a sense of how do you see the debt of this country playing out?
Well, it's sobering, and we are staring into an abyss of debt that is concerning. I think even for the government, these aren't numbers to be taken lightly. It's all manageable as long as growth exceeds interest rates. The math is that simple. We can grow our way out of this over a decade. And presently, interest rates look like they're going to be low for a very long time. So we've got a bit of runway here, but that runway doesn't go forever. It doesn't go the whole decade necessarily. So as the economy returns to a bit of a new normal and rates presumably go up, that can be a good thing. How do we ensure that growth stays ahead of those rates? Because that's been a sort of a challenge for Canada over the decades at different points. And that's where that multiplier is really important, because growth isn't just pumping money into the system, which is a bit of what we've got now. It's got to be productive investments, including from the private sector. And that's where really the magic of the economy.
Let me press you a little bit on this notion that interest rates are going to stay low for a long time. We have a situation where, whether it's in the United States, you hear people talking about inflation, and inflation is typically, you try and cool it down with rising rates. We heard this week from the Bank of Canada, they're sort of signaling that rates are going to increase. Like, are you concerned at all about inflation and potentially rates that could rise quickly?
It's such an interesting moment in economic history right now, because we're seeing price surges, commodities being an obvious point. And as the economy opens up, there'll be demand surges. So what you pay for an airline ticket or a movie ticket, there's going to be more demand than supply for a lot of things. And that leads to price increases. But inflation, as you know, is a basket. And there's plenty of things in the basket that will remain flat. Rent, for instance, is probably going to remain flat. Wages, as people come back into the labor force, is probably not going to be the pressure that it may historically have been. And something that's often overlooked is the power of the digital economy, digital transformation, which has been a really powerful force in terms of keeping inflation down, because supply grows much more quickly in a digital environment than it does in a physical environment. You don't have the same constraints. And we've seen that through the pandemic. Consumption has remained strong, in part because of the power of the digital economy and digital platforms, which actually do manage to curtail inflation, although there's certainly episodes where that may not seem to be the case. But in aggregate, it keeps things in line. Add to that, Peter, the mood of central banks, especially the Bank of Canada and the Fed especially, seems to be very cautious on this front. And by cautious, I mean they're not eager to raise rates, even though they see signals of growth there. The Fed is more concerned than I've seen them in the past about the labor side of the economy, about full employment and seeing people come back into the labor force. So I think they'll go slower than they might have historically.
I have to be honest, like, I'm personally more concerned about it. I'm just looking at how everything in the economy ultimately traces itself back to natural resources. Digital stuff, you can't eat bits and bites, you eat food, food's inflating, oil, lumber, base metals, everything. And we've only just begun with this whole transformation and then stimulus on top of that. I guess I grew up in the 70s, so I remember the days of inflation, you know, 10, 15%, interest rates ratcheting up every corner, 20% mortgage rates. I know we're not headed there anytime in the near term, but boy, it can get away on you really quickly if you're not careful. It's probably the subject of a whole separate discussion and we should move on, but I think we're going to be talking about that again.
History repeats. Never forget that. I remember those days as well. And if there's any probably lesson to really remember, is that inflation has a life of its own. And once it gains momentum, gains steam, it's hard to control.
Let's hope the central banks, though, they operate a lot differently than they did back then. So hopefully it would never get to that level. Can you imagine Canadians today with the mortgages they've taken on, if we had interest rates even at half of that level you're talking about, Peter?
Yeah.
It would be pretty damaging to the economy. All right, let's talk about Canadian energy future. Great day to talk about it with the news yesterday of Canada even taking on more ambitious reduction goals. So, John, you've written recently about the role of Canadian oil and gas. In fact, you recently wrote an article saying that Canada should grow our oil and gas because there's an energy-hungry world out there. And if the world's going to grow in its use of oil and gas, why wouldn't Canada be part of that? Do you still stick with that now that you see these big reduction targets?
We will continue to need oil and gas for the foreseeable future. The horizon of what foreseeable future means may have moved forward, or if we're serious about these targets, it will move forward. But oil and gas and the demand for oil and gas is not going to disappear next year or 5 years or even 10 years from now. I think most serious thinkers in the space understand that. The challenge really is to ensure that the oil and gas that we're producing and consuming is more and more efficient from a carbon and environmental impact point of view as we develop other technologies, other energy technologies to continue to power the economy. If you just look at the IEA forecast this week, it has been quite a week, are really interesting to compare and contrast with the governmental targets. They are seeing growing demand, and I think we'll see that this summer when Americans are back on the road. Our consumer economy is still very much dependent on oil and gas. That's going to continue for a while longer. So we need to be very thoughtful and constructive about how we work with that demand and ensure that we are investing in the technologies, I'm sure we'll get into this, that allow us to meet those very ambitious targets.
Now, you have written that it's time now to have a national discussion on this topic. What does that discussion look like without people having to take blood pressure pills?
We need to keep it to math and not ideology. This is not religion. If you do the math, it almost invariably leads to the importance, even criticality, of oil and gas. It's a quarter of our emissions. That's the production of oil and gas, not the consumption. And if we are going to meet these targets, and I think the federal government recognizes this quite fully and seriously, we have to do that through the oil and gas sector. Not a matter of shutting it down. That, I think, from an engineering perspective, actually may not be possible. And also from an economics perspective, is probably really unwise. But the greatest delta in the near term, i.e. in the decade ahead that Canada has on emissions reduction, frankly, is through the oil and gas sector. So how do we as a nation help the industry, this is our moonshot, substantially reduce its emissions? I think the industry is totally on for this, but we all have to get involved in it because it's not up to the industry to pull this off. This is too big a national challenge.
You're right. A technology is not necessarily the limiting factor here. It does require capital. This is a huge industry in this country. It's the largest resource industry by far, 10 times the size of forestry and many of other resource sectors. So retooling and changing processes around to become net zero, however it's done, requires a lot of capital. I know that big purveyors of capital like RBC, banks like yours, are under a lot of pressure to divest of, not give any more money to oil and gas companies. How do we square the circle? I mean, they need the capital. They need access to things like, I'll just call them green bonds, to be able to reduce emissions. Yet increasingly, the financial institutions are pressured not to give them money. So how do we break out of this cycle?
I know it's semantics, but maybe I should stress, I don't think we give anyone money.
We're
lending and financing. But in all seriousness, we are financing constructive, productive, progressive initiatives in the economy. That's what we try to do. And we see a lot of those opportunities in the oil and gas sector. We understand the concerns around climate finance. We do a ton of work on this, are involved in lots of the global conversations on how to substantially scale sustainable finance. We've made huge commitments ourselves at RBC and happy to get into some of what that is leading to. But an important aspect of sustainable finance, in our view, is to ensure that these funds are going into the productive sectors, and that includes oil and gas, that can invest the money in projects, in capital, in technologies that give us a demonstrable reduction in emissions. And then the onus is on us and our partners, our clients, to show that, to demonstrate that to shareholders and to the general public. We get that. This is what the disclosure movement is all about. It's a new frontier And we are fully committed to being at the forefront of that. But walking away from this challenge for the sector is not going to make the challenge go away. We're keen to work with the leaders in the sector who have the technology, who have the capital, who have the market savvy to help lead Canada on this commitment that we're very much behind to get to net zero.
So the federal government has allocated $17 billion in this budget, which in the big scheme of things is actually not that much, given that we have to retool large parts of our economy. So to be able to do that requires lending from banks such as yours, just broadly in the economy. So how much have you guys notionally at RBC earmarked or allocated? How much of your lending portfolio is going to go to decarbonization?
Yeah, we've committed $500 billion to sustainable finance by 2025, and we're willing to increase that based on market demand and client demand. Something quite extraordinary hit us last year where we allocated, we thought, a substantial amount of capital to this, and it was quickly taken up. There is more and more demand out there for this kind of financing. And it's not just the money. It's the syndicates that you can put together of investors. It's the savvy that a financial institution might be able to bring to help clients develop better approaches to their own sustainability. So we're seeing more demand, not less, and you know, we'll continue to allocate more to that as demand grows.
John, I have a question. When you say you've allocated towards green finance, I know there's a big debate globally, but also within this country, to what is the definition of green energy financing? Would you include investments in reducing hydrocarbon greenhouse gas emissions? So for example, CCS projects or blue hydrogen, would those be included in your definition?
It's an important question, Jackie, and that's something we would consider to be green if it is leading to a demonstrated reduction in carbon emissions.
Actually, John, can you sort of take us through the RBC vetting process for ESG? Because I know a lot of financial institutions, whether it's big pension plans or banks and other capital providers, have now ESG vetting processes. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's part of our risk assessment, which banks have for generations been very sophisticated at. And when there's major loans being made or major financing commitments being made, that goes through a risk committee. And increasingly, we're adding both talent and technology. A lot of data goes into this. We'll analyze from an environmental risk point of view and a climate risk point of view what the costs and benefits might be of a certain commitment.
And when you go through this ESG vetting process, the E is obviously a big focus of the greenhouse gas emissions. We've been talking about that. Is there any interest in some of the other measures like the social and the governance?
This is such an interesting conversation because E has been sort of the dominant force in the last couple of years, maybe longer. And I think it's generally recognized that we probably have overlooked, as a society, you can connect that to a lot of political movements. There are significant elements of society, which is another way of using the S, that feel either disenfranchised or not part of what's going on in capital markets or the economy more broadly. So analyzing that from a risk point of view is really tricky. Social factors are even more complex than environmental factors or governance factors because they are subjective and in some ways political and multivariate from the way, let's say, a company we're working with treats indigenous communities or works with local communities to its employment standards. So it's probably the most complex aspect of ESG and one that is going to be probably more tested in the years ahead.
Well, and diversity, I think, is another one that's starting to get a lot more focus even in the last year.
Absolutely. I mean, just a signal of that. We see in the US recently with companies pulling away from jurisdictions based on voting laws in the southern U.S. That's extraordinary. I don't think anyone would have predicted that a couple of years ago. Extend that to a risk analysis as part of ESG. That becomes a much hotter debate because many would see that as a political decision. Others would see it as a very reasonable part of an ESG framework. So that's where we think some of the debate will go in the next while.
Yeah, it's really companies are being asked to do much more than just deliver profit, right? They're expected to have these broader social impacts by some.
But getting back to the E and getting back to the net zero target by 2030 and the recent commitment by our federal government to reduce by 45% relative to 2005. So this is going to take a wholesale effort by corporate Canada across the board, all of our industries. Some are fairly carbon intense out of oil and gas. So you're at a very interesting perch there atop one of Canada's, actually the world's largest banks. And what you hear and see, to what extent do you think corporate Canada is ready to finance themselves to net zero? Because it's going to take a lot of money. It's going to take debt. What are you hearing, seeing actually outside the oil and gas industry?
We're hearing a fairly strong commitment to this. I think there are very few companies that are not serious and increasingly serious about net zero strategies. How we get there is being rapidly developed, and how we finance it is still newish territory. So that's going to take a lot of work over the next number of years. But I don't think anyone is seriously resistant to it. They're just trying to figure out the most logical approach and the best way to get going. The challenge in many ways for the targets, which is described as ambitious, is that it's probably going to take some more risk, collective risk, than we might have in the past on the technology side. It's hard to look at the commitment of 40 to 45% and think that the policies we've got in place are the ones that are going to get us there. Carbon pricing, clean fuel standards, and the like, regulation. Mm-hmm. Those will get us some of the way, but we're going to need some pretty big technology breakthroughs. You mentioned carbon capture. That's a space where we've got to have huge breakthroughs. That's going to require massive investments, both public and private, and a pretty accelerated approach to it, because we hope to get to this by 2030. Not by 2040. So that's like 9 years for industrial innovation at scale is almost unprecedented. So that's going to take more risk, I think, than a lot of Canadians have thought through. And we've got to think through, how do we manage those risks, such as technologies not scaling sufficiently or not working as predicted? That's kind of an inevitable part of technology. So how do we manage the risk?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, actually. I hadn't fully thought about it that way. We should have, because, you know, we're hearing the term moonshot by definition, you know, that was exceedingly risky. And so it is risky here. So the culture of risk in this country has to change. And the culture of risk even in your own bank has to change.
So, John, I have one other question. I think in some ways, the risk has come down because of a lot of the policies that the Liberals have rolled out. Now we have some line of sight to a really high price on carbon by 2030. And you know, with these goals, maybe that would be even moved up. We've got this clean fuel standard, which could provide fairly high credits for reducing your emissions. Has that changed how you look at investing in these areas? Because I think it has reduced the risk if you can kind of get paid that much for reducing carbon.
If there can be confidence in the regulatory framework surviving political cycles, then that eases a lot of investor minds. I think we're much closer to that in Canada than in other countries. There's a lot of uncertainty still in the US, for instance, given the political dynamics there. And we've gone through a lot over the last decade and have a framework now that most Canadians seem confident in. And now we have to get going on the business side and the capital side to start to do what the private sector does. That's going to require a fair amount of state capital, and the budget certainly signals an opening to that. And if we think of carbon capture, for instance, tens of billions of dollars may be needed in that space. A big amount of that is going to have to come from government investing, not just spending. But hopefully a lot of it comes from the private sector too, because the return there is going to be appealing. So that's going to take a bit of a new approach to capital projects in this country, to have significant state investment, hopefully led by the private sector and by private capital, that delivers very competitive, attractive returns over time. And when you have confidence in the regulatory framework, then you can have confidence in those returns.
I agree with you. I think that we're getting some more confidence. It was nice to see the Conservatives put out some policy that looks like they're interested in reductions as well. Well, to wrap up this great conversation, we talked about the importance for the Canadian economy, for growth, to keep being strong so that we can live with the debt that we have. And I think that's the other opportunity here. All of this will result in a lot of investment in Canada, a lot of growth in our economy, mm-hmm. and hopefully enable us to grow enough so that our debt doesn't become an issue. Thanks so much for joining our podcast today, John.
Yeah, many thanks.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to our listeners. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate us on the app that you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.